Wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
5 minutes, Your Honor.
All right. You may begin when you're ready.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. If it may please the court, I am Herbert E. Taylor III. I am counsel for the appellant in this matter, Philip Allen Chambers. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today on Mr. Chambers' appeal of a conviction of unlawfully discharging a firearm in an occupied building in violation of Virginia Code 18.2279. Basically, there are two issues that I would like to bring before you today. First is that we believe that the trial court failed to give proper weight to showing that the defendant did not intend to discharge the firearm in his residence, and that such failure was an abuse of discretion on the part of the trial court.
Wasn't that basically a credibility question, whether or not he believed your client's version, whether or not he believed the version that law enforcement ascribed to your client?
I think that it could be, but I don't necessarily agree in this case that it is, because I think that there is evidence surrounding a statement which would indicate that this was, in fact, an accident as opposed to a deliberate act on his part. The second issue is that we believe that the Commonwealth did not prove an essential element to the crime. That is, that a life or lives of a person occupying the building may have been put in peril.
Mr. Taylor, on that first point, and I know you disagree with the assumption I'm asking you to make, so
right.
Please bear with me there. But assuming that he did intentionally shoot into the wall, and would that be sufficient to prove that unlawful discharge element of the offense?
I think it's tied in to some extent to whether or not the building was occupied and whether or not somebody was in actual peril.
Yeah, there's two elements. One, in such a manner as to endanger the lives. But would that be sufficient to prove the first element, that he unlawfully discharged a firearm, if he intentionally pulled the trigger?
Under this statute, I don't know that it would.
Okay.
With regard to the discharge of the firearm and the fact that it was accidental, I think what is abundantly clear in this case is that on the evening of November 16th, several officers of the Amherst County Sheriff's Department came into the defendant's home, woke him from a nap, startling him. There's a question as to whether or not they announced themselves or not. After a brief discussion with the defendant, and we really don't know what that discussion was. So I think we know that it was perfunctory, and it didn't go into whether or not the firearm was discharged accidentally. The officers then bundle him up, ECO him, and take him to the hospital for observation. He wasn't arrested at that time.
If he tells the officer, "I have a right to shoot my own wall," doesn't that lead to the natural inference that it was an intentional discharge?
Not necessarily. It could be just his frame of mind as to what kind of ownership he has in property.
But couldn't the judge, within his discretion, conclude from that it was an intentional discharge?
Could have. I'll concede that.
So under our standard of review, isn't that the end of the discussion? If the judge could have drawn that conclusion, we're looking at the evidence in a light most favorable to the Commonwealth. That's the conclusion that we're going to have to adopt.
I think the other issue is could have versus should have, and I think that when we look at the evidence,
substituting our own judgment for that of the trial court, would it not?
Well, but that happens with this court.
Well, I mean, if we took the... We try not to.
Well,
and I understand that. But it does. I mean, when you get into cases where you're looking at the sufficiency of the evidence, I think to some extent that involves a review of what the judge saw. And there are cases which indicate that
But only when we have to conclude that no reasonable jurist could have come to that conclusion.
And
you just told us that it was a reasonable conclusion for a judge to draw in this case.
Your Honor, anything is possible with regard to a judge. Okay, so you ask whether or not it could have happened. It could be the case. All right. I think the point we're trying to make here is that we have two separate events. One was when the officers showed up, and I think by anybody's view of the facts there, this was a case where they had been called in on what might have been an attempted suicide. They got up to the room, they threw him down, not threw him down, they put him down on the bed. He resisted, I can't say he was disoriented because that's not what's in the record, but he was certainly startled. I think that's what he said. And then they whisk him off to the hospital. Nobody at that time asked him anything about how that gun discharged. They didn't ask him whether or not it was done on purpose or by accident. The issue came up several days later, 9 days later, when the officers come back and to arrest him, and that at that point in time, he talks about the fact that it went off accidentally. And to tell you the truth, the Commonwealth, I think in its brief, puts great stock in the fact that the defendant did not tell the officers on November 16th that the firearm went off accidentally. I don't even think he had the chance to tell them. I think that the officers were in there to pick him up and to take him to the hospital. So from that standpoint, and the other thing I'd point to is that when you look at what happened at trial, I think it was not until trial that the defendant was asked by anyone from the Commonwealth to explain how the gun discharged, and then he did so in detail. And I would direct you to the appendix, pages 48 and those that are following it, where he gives a very detailed statement of what happened. So what you have on one side is a very confused situation where the officers are coming in, and he may or may not have made some statements. In some cases, he denies the statements that he made.
Lieutenant Davis testified that at the scene, initially at the scene, that your client said that he had the right to shoot in his house if he wanted to.
And as I said, that statement could have meant that it was a declaration of the defendant's concept of ownership of property that we can care for or not care for. I'm sorry?
Didn't he also say that he put the hole in the wall?
And it was pointing to one wall, but we don't know that was the hole that was left by the discharge of the firearm.
And that he just wanted to die.
And if that's the case, then I think you look at that statement from the standpoint of, well, this was an attempted suicide. And what happens is, when they come in, they find him asleep. That doesn't make much sense for somebody who is attempting a suicide.
Mr. Davis, can I focus you a moment on your second assignment of error, putting the occupant in danger? How do we get around Dowdy versus Commonwealth, the Supreme Court case in 1979, that basically says that if you shoot at or into an occupied dwelling, that in and of itself endangers anybody in the house, and that's all the Commonwealth has to establish?
I think you have to look at the factual situation behind each case to maybe understand what a decision is. Sometimes we have statements made by the court that, if you take them out of context then and apply them to every case, then may be
something. Let me read you the quote that I have a problem with. With this history in mind, we construe the language of the present statute as a legislative declaration that human lives may be endangered when a deadly weapon is maliciously discharged at or against a building occupied people, and that such conduct is felonious. In our view, this legislative determination relieves the Commonwealth of the burden of proving that human life was in fact endangered. And that seems to be your argument. There's no evidence that this other person was endangered, so therefore the statute wasn't violated. How do I write an opinion and get around that declaration?
Well, look at Dowdy as being a malicious wounding case in the first place, not an unlawful wounding case.
No, Dowdy's a maliciously discharged a firearm.
Right, malicious case. This isn't the case.
Well, the only
in
difference
Chambers
is whether it's done maliciously or whether it's done unlawfully.
Could be. And you look at the facts of the case that they were looking at with regard to what happened there. And as I recall, you had the defendant shooting through or into the front door, and the I think it was the wife of an officer who was in the rear of the building. And I think that is distinguishable from this case, if you look at the evidence.
But we're getting beyond the facts. So what I'm concerned about with Judge Petty's question is the statement that he just read and how that establishes the law of what constitutes endangerment.
And I understand, and I read the case, and I understand that's what the court said, and you've asked me to distinguish it, and the only way I can distinguish it
fair enough
is to say that was a malicious wounding case where the facts are significantly different from the case at hand. Whether that carries the day or not, Your Honor, I don't know. That's for
you're into your rebuttal. You can continue your reserve as you wish.
I don't know whether the courts have any questions with regard to the issue of preservation of this.
Yes, sir. I do have a question about that.
So I'll take that and eat into my rebuttal time because I figured it was coming. I will concede that we did not preserve it at trial, as the Commonwealth has argued in their brief. I do believe that the transcript of the trial is very has in it a significant amount of evidence with regard to where the parties were or weren't at the time. And I believe that this is a case where this court should consider this issue because it would promote the ends of justice. I am familiar with Brittle versus Commonwealth. I'm sure the court is, since it's a decision out of this court. And I think if we walk down the rationale or the process of getting to the end, and I can do that if you want, but I think that it's something that probably you're familiar with, we must show that the defendant was convicted of conduct that was not a criminal offense. And if you look at that issue of whether or not somebody is in peril, that's obviously important. It's a provision of the statute. So in this case, we believe the Commonwealth failed to prove that at the time the firearm was discharged, the life of someone occupying the house may have been put in peril. It was a physical impossibility. At that point, if you look at the evidence, the wife was downstairs somewhere, he was upstairs somewhere. That's an essential element of the crime. So I think we can by applying Brittany, get down to that point, and then the manifest injustice in this case is that the defendant was convicted of a felony that he shouldn't have been convicted of. So on that basis, we're asking the court to reverse and dismiss or otherwise grant a new trial.
Thank you. Ms. Kiernan?
Good afternoon again, Your Honors. I remain Susan Baumgartner for the Office
sorry,
of the
Attorney
General. Sorry,
I said Ms. Kiernan. I was looking at my timer.
Your Honor, starting with the second issue of whether or not the evidence proved that anyone was actually endangered. The defense has just conceded this was not preserved, which means that he must show that an element didn't occur to establish a miscarriage of justice. However, given the line of cases with Dowdy, Strickland, and Ellis, it has been established that any sort of discharge in an occupied building puts those people at risk.
Ms. Bronco, let me ask you that, and I guess it focuses more on the first issue, but
sure.
It's one that, quite frankly, gives me a lot of pause. Suppose I live out here in beautiful Rockbridge County, a lot of hunting going on, a lot of target practicing, no ordinance about shooting in the county. And I go down to my basement and I set up a bullet trap. for a .22 caliber pistol. And I'm down in my basement, and I'm target practicing in what is a very safe environment. My wife is two floors up in the bedroom. Have I committed a crime?
Well, under the current case law, I think arguably you have, because the current case law says discharging in an occupied building is sufficient to show that lives are at risk. However, you're also talking about some sort of safe environment. I don't know exactly what you mean by safe.
But if we follow your logic and argument in this case, we are going to be telling people that take a pellet gun even downstairs. You may be committing a felony by engaging in what is otherwise safe conduct.
I don't think that's just my logic, Your Honor. I think that's the logic of the precedent in this case. However, you are suggesting that there might be some sort of special shooting range or precautions taken in the basement.
What about that? What about an actual shooting range?
Well, in shooting,
and it's occupied.
In shooting ranges, I presume that there is some sort of precaution taken so that there is not the ricochet.
The key word in the statute is unlawfully. I mean,
yes.
Maliciously or unlawfully. What is unlawful about the conduct I've just described?
Of the shooting range?
Of the shooting range or in my basement. What is unlawful about me doing that?
Well, I think it's unlawful if it endangers the other people in the building or yourself.
So the guy that's target practicing in the shooting range is committing a felony?
Not if there are precautions taken to prevent that endangerment. And I also would imagine that there's some sort of codes or statutes involving the regulations of shooting ranges and some sort of safety precautions that are taken.
I mean, it just seems to me we have to get to that unlawful. I mean, you know, I live in Lynchburg, and there's an ordinance against shooting in the city. So I could see, okay, well, you shoot in the city, you've done it unlawfully. That's why it's unlawful conduct. But if I live in an area where shooting is not prescribed, what I'm doing is not in any way unlawful.
Correct. If it's not prescribed somehow. However, I think under the current status of the law, you can't set up a shooting range in a dwelling house. And even if you can somehow do that, in this case, this was no area that was specially tricked out to prevent some sort of ricochet from coming either back at the defendant himself or going through the walls or the floors into his house.
Would that be part of the distinction in the shooting range example? Shooting it downrange into an area that's designed to accept, control, and in fact capture the round as opposed to just turning sideways and firing it at the wall on the firing line.
Absolutely, because I think what Strickland really makes clear is that if you shoot it into, in Strickland, the man entered a hospital and shot it into the ceiling, and the court talked about the risk of ricochet. And the risk of ricochet, when you're shooting it at the ceiling or the wall, there's definitely a risk of what it's going to hit and when it's going to bounce.
Could the distinction perhaps be that it is unlawful to recklessly handle a firearm? If you're intoxicated and you're just shooting into walls, you are recklessly handling the firearm, and then it's thus unlawful.
That could be a distinction made. I mean, certainly with a shooting range, the thought is if you're practicing at a shooting range, it is in fact to become a safer shooter as opposed to shooting up your walls after expressing suicidal ideation.
Sure, if we adopt your argument, we're not setting a precedent that perhaps we ought not be setting.
Mm-hmm. Well, Your Honor, as I said, I don't think my argument creates new precedent. I think it's strongly established in this case. And as was discussed earlier, this was ultimately a credibility decision about whether or not this was an accidental shooting. And there were a number of items that addressed that credibility. For instance, the defendant testified that he had taken the clip out of his gun. This was his whole explanation. He took the clip out of his gun when he napped, but not when he went to bed at night, so that his dog didn't accidentally fire the gun. The police testified, however, that the clip was in the gun. He didn't say it was an accident at the time, and I believe there was a lot more conversation going on in both versions of the story than was discussed earlier. Also, the fact that he was suicidal and possibly aiming the gun at himself as an intended target as opposed to just a possible target was corroborated by the fact that he was held for 2 days in a hospital. He was taken to one hospital that held him 9 hours, then he was transferred for another 47 hours to another hospital. And also he made a very detailed statement about how the gun, he removed the clip and then he was trying to rack it to remove the round that was in the chamber, but it went off and he had no idea how it went off, that the court found just simply didn't make sense given how knowledgeable he said he was about firearms. So I think the court was entitled to make a credibility decision about whether or not he intentionally fired the gun instead of an accident, and it certainly can't be said that that was plainly wrong. Regarding the endangerment of lives, as I said, he must show for ends of justice that the element didn't occur, and given the case law that's currently controlling in this matter, there was a potential ricochet. Both the defendant and his wife were at risk from him firing a gun into the wall. If there are no further questions, I urge you to affirm.
Thank you very much. Mr. Taylor, you have a little bit of your rebuttal remaining.
Thank you, Your Honor.
With regard to the shooting range, is it then unlawful, instead of shooting down the range, that all of a sudden you drop the gun or you're holding the gun and it goes off and somebody is injured? It's even shooting ranges are dangerous. We know that from the news with regard to people, and in fact case I think was out in Arizona or someplace where a young girl was killed because of that. So I think the critical language here is may imperil, and when you look at Dowdy and you look at Strickland and you look at Kirby, the sense I get from all those cases is that proximity is very important. Shooting into a ceiling, which I think is either Strickland or Kirby, maybe Kirby. Strickland, I think, is the case where there was actually a shot that went from one room to another and ended up coming within 5 feet, I think, of somebody. That's not this case. Proximity is, at least from what's on the record, is that they were very far apart, and it's the Commonwealth who has the burden of showing that it may imperil.
Does the person whose life is endangered have to be someone other than the shooter?
That's certainly the impression you get from the decisions of Strickland, Kirby, and Dowdy. They're talking about potential victims.
The question has not come up before, but we have held, for instance, fleeing a police officer, which has similar language, that it's a felony if it endangers the life of another. We have held that another can mean the driver of the car. So why can't the person whose life is endangered be the person who actually shot the gun?
I don't know that it couldn't, but I don't know that we have a case under this statute
that really
construes it that way. I think this statute is to construe that if you unlawfully, or if you shoot a, if you discharge a firearm, that you're looking at what may happen to others in the place.
Thank you very much for your argument.
Thank you.
We will greet counsel, and then we will stand adjourned.